Hi, and welcome to the Jordan Kinda Knows Something show, where I'll be talking about health, fitness, life, and anything else I kinda know something about.
Reduce the risk of ovarian cancer, of breast cancer, of endometrial cancer, of prostate cancer, lung cancer even, cardiovascular mortality, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, lowered cholesterol, improved artery function, lowered blood pressure, improved cognitive function, improved weight loss, and also those soy phytoestrogens in particular, decreased hot flash severity and frequency, and reduced vaginal dryness and menopause.
What is going on, everyone, and welcome to another episode. Now, I am in a pretty bad mood right now, and I know all of you thinking are like, what could you be in a bad mood for, Jordan? You're free. You're living in South Australia. You can go outside and whatnot. Wrong. We are currently in lockdown, which freaking sucks. And I know in like every freaking intro, I talk about how, oh, South Australia, we're good. We're not in lockdown and we're free and no changes. And I'm just angry. So essentially the story, or the long story, is we have 14 new COVID cases here in South Australia. And basically, the government reacted, which at the end of the day isn't the worst thing. It's good that they caught it on early, but they put us in pretty much the strictest lockdown that the world has seen. So essentially, we are currently in the lockdown that Italy was facing back 4 or 5 months ago. So we are not allowed to leave our homes at all. I actually have a letter that I received from school, because me working in the hospital as a physiotherapy student, I am considered essential worker right now. So I actually have this letter. So anytime that I leave home, which has been one or two times now where police have stopped me and have asked me why I'm outside, and I just show them the letter because I'm on my way to work or on my way home for work, and that's that. Whereas if I didn't have that letter, I would get arrested because we are not allowed outside at all. I think groceries, one person from every household is allowed out for 2 hours per day for grocery shopping. And that is essentially, I think there's specific hours, I think like 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. or something like that. Like grocery stores aren't open all day like they normally are. We are not allowed outside to exercise. So you cannot even work, like you can't work out outside, you can't go for a walk, you can't walk your dog, you can't do anything, you have to stay inside. So it has been so strict, and thankfully I have been at work in the hospital, so I haven't really been at home bored, essentially, because yeah, I've been at work. So, but you know, it's Saturday right now, and just kind of sitting at home watching movies all day, and I thought, oh, I might as well record the intro to this episode and make myself a little busy because there is absolutely nothing to do. So yeah, it sucks, but you know, hopefully they tackle this and they get it kind of under control. I mean, even though that there's only 14 cases, it's probably going to skyrocket from those 14, but I think their intention was to kind of, I guess, catch it early and, I don't know, maybe see where the traces come from or whatever, but hopefully by Christmas time, it'll be good because, you know, here in Australia, Christmas is the opposite season to North America, where now it's kind of like summertime, so the weather's getting nice and I can go to the beach, but can't go to the beach this weekend, which sucks. So yeah, that's basically my little rant for the beginning of this episode, because I have nothing better to talk about. Just kind of stuck at home inside right now. But what I have been doing actually is working out inside in my living room. I, from that first kind of, I guess, I mean, the first time when the thick of it, like 4 or 5 months ago, when the cases were a lot higher, we weren't essentially under lockdown back then. Like, this lockdown was so much worse than back then when we had like 200 cases. But back then, I did like gyms were closed and whatnot. So I did buy a couple dumbbells, bands, and things like that. So thankfully, I was actually gonna sell those stuff like a couple weeks ago because I thought, oh, we've had zero cases for like 4 months now. We're gonna be fine. But thankfully, I was too lazy to sell all that stuff because I still have it and I've just been doing workouts inside. So I thought maybe I'd chat a little bit in the beginning of this episode of things that I'm doing and a few things that I know Ryan from the previous episode, talking about bodybuilding and stuff, did mention a few of these tips in his episode. So definitely go check that episode out as well if you are at home or if your gyms are closing. You can still work out at home and you can still maintain, build muscle, and not lose strength. So, a few things that I've been doing essentially is one, making sure that the quality of the movements that I'm doing are good. So, not swinging my elbows if I'm doing bicep curls, not doing, let's say push presses or using momentum if I'm doing overhead press with a dumbbell, like just making sure that the tempo and I'm getting full quality movement with every exercise. That really, really helps make workouts a lot more challenging, even if you're like me and you don't have heavy weights at home. Like I have like a 10 kilo dumbbell, that's the heaviest I have. So making sure that everything is super quality, you are focusing on tempo. You can make things super hard with tempo training, if you're doing a squat, for example, spending 3 seconds on that descent of the squat, pausing at the bottom and then exploding up, that'll make the squat a lot harder. Doing 10 reps of tempo squats will make it a lot harder, opposed to just going down and up if you had a heavier weight. So tempo training, quality of reps is something that I am focusing on. And the second thing that I wanted to mention is just making a plan. So making sure that you are structuring your week and your workouts in a good order so that you're hitting everything minimum 2 times per week, especially when you're at home and you are using like these lighter weights. I would definitely recommend hitting all of your muscle groups twice a week, giving about 72 hours of rest in between each muscle group and just tackling it constantly, just so that you don't lose that muscle build that you have done. And it'll kind of help you gain and maintain more so that strength and that hypertrophy that you have gained. So those are things that I've been focusing on and that I really recommend you focus on, especially if you are working out at home right now. There are even things that you can do in the gym. Tempo training is always something that you can do instead of just racking up the weights heavier and heavier and heavier each week. Keep it a little bit lighter and do some tempo training. You'd be surprised how hard it can get and how effective it can be. So that is essentially what I've been doing, but let's maybe get into today's episode. So, I really, really wanted to have kind of a professional on this plant-based series that knew what he was talking about specifically with the science. So, today's episode is going to focus a lot on background science and bringing in a lot of this science into plant-based diet and into myths that we still to this day hear. When you think of being vegan or when you think of being plant-based, there are so many myths in soy and muscle building and vitamins and minerals and is vegan actually really healthy and this and that. And one thing that I think a lot of people on Instagram you see, or a lot of people on YouTube and this and that, that you see, offering nutrition advice and offering advice on anything really, really lack the science and really kind of offer tips and tricks that work for them, which is great. You know, what works for them is amazing and maybe it'll work for you, but not everything is going to work for you. So if you are seeing something on Instagram, for example, maybe you're seeing something about this, I don't know, this probiotic mixable drink or whatever. You're seeing an influencer promote it and how it benefits them with their skin and with their digestion and all this and that. Well, that's great, but this product benefited them and they're probably getting paid to make that promotion on Instagram. So, you know, it's not necessarily going to probably work for you. Maybe it will. Who knows? But I really, really kind of try and look for science behind things that I am reading, especially online or in videos or something like that, or even on Instagram. You know, those influencers that take the time to actually back up what they're saying through science or through, you know, listening to a podcast or watching a YouTube video of, you know, a doctor who has done the research. Those are kind of more reputable sources that I think is a lot safer to follow. And if things kind of work for you or don't work for you and you're following the science, it's probably a lot better. In a sense that, you know, if you're following something like what an influencer says and it's not backed up by science and you're trying it for 30 days, well, at the end of that 30 days, if it doesn't work, that's 30 days that you just lost, you know? So why not maybe cut that 30 days of you trying by maybe following somebody who has backed up their kind of opinion by science, and you seeing that, okay, well, the science is telling you or the data is telling you that this works because of this, and you know, you then have that kind of information of, oh, well, that's probably going to work for me because I fall under that category. So that's the reason why I want to have this guest on the podcast today, because he is very knowledgeable in the science. He is very knowledgeable in all the topics that we are discussing today. We're talking about soy, we're talking about vitamins, we're talking about protein and this and that. So yeah, I am talking to Dr. Mathurum Nagra. He is a naturopathic doctor based out of Vancouver, British Columbia, my hometown. So definitely stick around for this episode and let's see what he has to say. All right, everyone. So I am sitting here with Dr. Mathurum Nagra. How are you doing today, Matthew?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Now, Dr. Matthew, you are a naturopathic doctor, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Cool. So do you mind maybe starting with just telling us a little bit about yourself, whatever you want to mention?
Yeah. So you mentioned I'm a naturopathic doctor. I practice in Vancouver, BC on Commercial Drive at Tanumi Integrated Health. Going back a little further, I've been 100% plant-based for almost 10 years now, and that makes up a pretty large portion of my practice. And I spend a lot of time online as well through social media, through you know, articles on my website, trying to explain the science behind plant-based nutrition in particular, and trying to expel as many common myths as I possibly can around the topic, which I'm sure we'll do a little bit of in this presentation here, or in this discussion here. And I also volunteer for the nonprofit nutritionfacts.org, which is a nonprofit website dedicated to providing evidence-based nutrition information, as well as volunteering for the Happy Herd Farm Sanctuary, which is a farm sanctuary or rescue here in Aldergrove, BC, where we rescue animals from the dairy industry, from the egg industry, and all over. And it's a really rewarding kind of a volunteer practice as well.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. And yeah, that's cool. Especially, I mean, the nutrition facts in that farm, that's cool that you mentioned that. Cause I mean, the reason why I wanted to have you on the podcast was basically because of all of your history, and you kind of, I know through your Instagram and through Nutrition Facts, I follow them as well. It is very evidence-based. And I think sometimes when you're on social media, you miss a lot of that, or people miss a lot of that kind of evidence-based kind of approach to things. And it's very easy to kind of scroll through Instagram and just kind of believe anything and not know exactly where things are coming from. So yeah, I really want to have you on the podcast because of the evidence you bring behind all of your arguments, which I think is awesome. But if you don't mind maybe starting with kind of speaking to your journey with being plant-based and being vegan. I know you said that you've done it for 10 years, which is quite a long time. And I know 10 years ago, it was a lot different than it is now. I mean, I've only been
vegan for about 6-ish years now, and 6 or 7 years now, and even 6 or 7 years, it's changed drastically. So do you mind maybe mentioning your journey with being vegan?
Yeah, it actually probably started 12 years ago, maybe 12 and a half, 13 years ago. I actually, when I was younger, I was overweight, I had asthma, had allergies. I was training with a personal trainer at the time because I was involved in some sports. And my trainer actually really pushed plant-based diets. He was very much into more of the raw food kind of realm.
Okay.
But he really pushed plant-based diets. He was very anti-dairy, actually, of all the different food groups. And I never really took him seriously. I mean, I was really young at the time. Right. And it wasn't until he wanted me to do a food diary, to write down everything I ate over the course of a few weeks. I think it was 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And he, I knew my diet was terrible. So I knew once he saw what I was eating, he was going to just kick my butt, basically. And so I thought, I'm going to eat super clean for these couple weeks.
Right.
So I cut out all the dairy. I cut out all your classic junk foods, like all the pops and chips and that. And I just started feeling better. Started losing weight. Skin cleared up. Asthma was already feeling better. Maybe that had to do with the dairy. I mean, who knows? My allergies got quite a bit better. And so I thought, okay, maybe he's on to something. Maybe there's something to this. And so I stuck with it. I ended up sticking with it for over 2 years. I kept learning more about the topic as well, learning as much as I could, reading, practicing. I ended up working in a little like raw vegan cafe type thing where I learned how to prepare different foods. And when I went to university, I kind of slid the other way. So I went to university my first semester there. I was still so much healthier than most of my peers.
Right.
But as you're eating in the cafeteria, as there's so many parties happening all the time, I could tell my health was sliding back the other way. And so slowly I was kind of losing that vitality that I had, how good I was feeling. And in my second semester, I actually decided one day, I was just like, I'm over it. I'm going all in. I want to get back to peak health. And I went to 100% plant-based at that point and have been ever since.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm super interested. Do you know the reason why your trainer was pushing towards a plant-based diet? Was there any specific reasoning that he mentioned? Because that's for me a new one. I know me growing up playing sports, and my sister actually was a high-level hockey player. And 6 or 7 years ago when I first went vegan, my sister and my mom was actually going to switch with me. And I remember my sister working with a trainer, strength and conditioning coach, and a chiropractor, and somebody else, I can't remember, but all I remember her being in a meeting and then just ripping everything about being vegan apart and being like, you can't be high level athlete, this and that, being vegan, that's stupid, whatnot. So I'm very interested. Do you know of any reasons why he was pushing towards a plant-based diet?
Well, from a health perspective, he knew it was healthier. Right. He definitely knew it was healthier. He knew that. He wasn't 100%. He did eat some fish. Pretty close. He knew that it was healthier to choose those plant-based, proteins and stuff over the animal proteins. And he was ultimately, seeing a lot of great results. I mean, he wasn't a guy that was maybe super, super well-versed in all the scientific literature, but he was seeing people perform incredibly on a plant-based diet all the time. All of his clients that he's coaching, he works with some really high level athletes. He himself was a pretty high level athlete as well. And so he just knew it could work. And then he knew about all the health benefits. So he was pushing it for that reason. Like, he wasn't just about performance. He was also about overall health and longevity.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah. That's a super interesting fact. Cause I was mentioning before, my sister kind of getting torn apart about going vegan. I've always find it surprising when, I mean, less so now because there are so many trainers now who are plant-based, but 10 years ago, that's very interesting. But I'm now interested in kind of getting into kind of the myths, which is what I wanted to get into with you. It's interesting because like 10 minutes ago, I got tagged or DM'd a message about a podcast of someone who made like an anti-vegan episode. And I was like, I haven't listened to it yet, but I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting because I think the episode was about everything that I wanted to talk to you about. And essentially, I'm just kind of interested in nutritional deficit myths. So that being kind of one thing. And I know there's a lot of stigma around if you go vegan, there is going to be some nutritional deficits that people will have. I know this podcast, for example, was mentioning that being vegan may help for like inflammation, but being vegan may lead to like deeper nutritional deficit issues down the road, which I mean, I don't necessarily agree with, but what kind of things do people need to be wary of, if any, when they are going on a plant-based diet nutritionally?
Okay, well, there's a couple things before we get into that. For one, when we look at what's actually causing disease and what's ultimately killing us these days, it's diseases of excess. It's not diseases of deficiency, right? People are dying of heart disease, diabetes, those sorts of issues. It's not because they're deficient in a given nutrient.
Okay.
That being said, when we look at the data, like population data, and it doesn't matter which population we look at. We can look at American populations. We've got data from Brazil, Spanish countries. We've got Finland, Switzerland. We have so much data on different populations, so different people eating different varieties of foods, where they actually compare vegans or vegetarians against meat eaters in that population.
Right.
And consistently, they have as good, if not better, nutrition.
Okay.
So when we're looking on a population level, people who are eating plant-based are actually doing better as far as nutrient intake goes.
Yeah.
Where you might, where concerns may come from is if one person ends up deficient in something, it's on the news. If it's if someone who's plant-based and they run into a serious deficiency, it's all over the place. They don't talk about the people like myself who've been doing it for 10 years and meeting almost 100% of my nutrient requirements in one meal. They're looking at these, extreme cases. That being said, there are a few that we might want to consider. For one, vitamin B12 is something that anybody on a vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian even, unless they're eating a fair amount of fish, even a flexitarian diet who are only eating animal products occasionally.
Right.
All of these people on all of these diets should be supplementing vitamin B12.
Right.
And that's because vitamin B12, yes, you can get it from animal products, and yes, you can get it from fortified foods, but it's a big problem in public health. A lot of people on all diets are deficient. In fact, after age 50, it's recommended that everybody supplement regardless of your diet.
Okay.
Just if you're eating plant-based and you're not getting any, you're not getting enough of that B12 intake in your diet, you just have to start supplementing at a younger age, throughout your entire life. That's the only real difference there. And even then, most people who are eating animal products are actually supplementing with B12 without knowing it. In fact, 55% of all the B12 that's produced gets sold to livestock. It's actually fed to animals in their feed.
Right.
So a lot of people there are supplementing anyway. Just get a supplement straight from the source. You don't need to get it via, an animal or even fortified foods. I mean, technically you could get enough through fortified foods if you're careful with it. But I would just not risk it. Risk of deficiency is serious. You can end up with anemia, neurological issues. If it goes on long enough, permanent, brain or cognitive impairment.
Right. Okay.
So just supplement. Super easy. It's one of the cheapest supplements on the planet.
Yeah.
If you go for the cyanocobalamin form, which is the cheapest form, you could literally get a year's supply for a couple dollars. It's that cheap.
Okay. So for people listening, what is vitamin B12? What does it, I guess, benefit?
So it's important for DNA production. And so it's important for blood cell production. If you're deficient, you can end up with anemia, very much like what you get from iron deficiency. It's a different form of anemia, and I won't go into all the specifics because I feel like you don't need to know. But it can lead to a specific type of anemia. But then it's also really important for nerve function, and that's where the really serious issues with long-term deficiency can come about.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's super interesting, vitamin B12, because it's I think it's something that I always hear some people kind of bring up, oh, well, you're going to be deficient in vitamin B12. But like you mentioned before, even non-vegans need to supplement or are supplementing without knowing. So
yeah. Yeah. And after age 50, everybody should be. And that's because like B12 isn't produced by animals. It's produced by bacteria. Right. So it's the bacteria in their guts, especially ruminant animals, that can produce B12. Mm-hmm. And I mean, unfortunately, when you're raising these animals in feedlots and feeding them foods that maybe they aren't necessarily supposed to be eating, you can end up with issues with B12 production for them as well, which is why they end up supplementing. So, okay. So it's just again, to reiterate, supplement B12.
Right. What about omegas? Because that's another thing I think alongside B12, especially in this whole like nutritional deficit thing, I always hear about omegas and it's being important for brain function and whatnot, and how, yes, we can get it with flax oil and all of that kind of stuff, but the conversion probably isn't the greatest. That is something that I've heard before and that I've been mentioned to before. So what about omega-3s or omega-6s? How do they play function in our health and should we be supplementing with them?
Okay, so this is a bit more of a complex topic. Right. So with omega-3s, and I'll just give your listeners kind of the background. There are a few different types of omega-3 fats.
Okay.
There's alpha-linolenic acid, which is ALA. That's what we get from flax seeds, chia seeds, walnuts, you know, all those plant foods.
Yeah.
Now that can eventually be converted into two other long chain omega-3s called eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA for short, and eicosahexaenoic acid, which is DHA for short. So you eat ALA, it gets converted into EPA and DHA. Now, as you mentioned, there is the issue of, well, what if you don't convert a ton of it? Then will you become deficient in EPA and DHA? And actually, because of that concern, it is recommended that people on a plant-based diet double the RDA for ALA, for the short-chain omega-3. So you eat twice as much. So you kind of compensate for that whole conversion that happens. Now, in most healthy people, I would say that that's enough. That seems to be enough. It's just making sure you're really doubling up. And it's very easy to do that. You throw in a tablespoon or two of ground flax seeds a day into your oatmeal or your smoothie, and you're done for the day. You've hit your target. It's incredibly easy to do that. Now, when we look at the amounts of EPA and DHA, those long-chain omega-3s in, say, vegans or vegetarians versus fish eaters, the levels actually aren't all that different. Okay. And that's, they might have slightly less, but it's not all that different. And that's because if you don't eat EPA and DHA, you actually increase your conversion rate. Okay. So you'll actually convert more if you're not eating that stuff. Hmm. So our bodies are kind of smart in that sense, that they do make sure you have enough.
Right.
But then the question becomes, well, is there going to be benefit to further supplementation?
Yeah.
Well, when we look at fish intake in most studies is actually associated with pretty good health outcomes. It's associated with usually a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, possibly lower risk of cognitive issues, like say Alzheimer's disease. However, fish consumption typically replaces meat consumption.
Right.
Right. If you're eating fish, you're not eating meat at that meal.
Right.
In most cases, of course, there can be exceptions.
Yeah.
So then we have to ask, well, is it actually the omega-3s in fish that are benefiting those people, or is it the fact that they're not getting all the saturated fat from the meat? And now with cardiovascular disease, we know that saturated fat is very strongly predictive or associated with heart disease risk, with cardiovascular disease risk. With Alzheimer's disease, actually a 2018 meta-analysis found that just 4 extra grams of saturated fat per day is associated with, I believe it was an 18% increased risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
So again, replacing those with fish can absolutely lead to a benefit. How we can ultimately determine if the omega-3s themselves are being beneficial here is we do supplement trials, and we have them. And in fact, supplement trials, when you put all the data together, don't seem to provide very good benefit for, say, Alzheimer's prevention. And with cardiovascular disease, if you are already a fairly healthy person, on average, don't provide a benefit either. Where supplementation seems to mostly benefit is in people who previously have had heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
Right.
So if you've already had a heart attack and you start supplementing, you can reduce your risk of having a subsequent heart attack. Okay. Cognitive impairment, if you have cognitive impairment, so you're lacking brain function and you supplement, you may improve your cognitive function. Okay. However, in a otherwise healthy person, the benefits are going to be very minimal.
Right. Okay.
So, when you start looking at it like that, it's not clear that there's actually a benefit to that. And if we look at, say, vegans or vegetarians, they already have a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, and they already have a lower risk of, say, Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
So they're already benefiting. And then the final real nail in the coffin for this whole discussion is we have what are called Mendelian randomization experiments. So these are where you actually look at people, their genetics, and you look at people with mutations that lead them to have higher levels of these omega-3 fats like EPA and DHA.
Mm-hmm.
And those with genetically elevated levels are not protected against cardiovascular disease and are not protected against Alzheimer's disease. So again, that leads me to believe that it's actually the reduction in other things like saturated fat that ends up leading to a benefit. Mm-hmm. So as a whole, for a healthy person, for an otherwise healthier person, I don't know that it's necessary to supplement.
Right.
But also it's a relatively safe thing to do. It's not like it's going to cause, or has a great chance of causing serious health issues. If you want to do it as an extra safety measure, then by all means, go ahead. But I do have an issue with people claiming that there's going to be, automatic deficiency otherwise. Except in two cases. There are a couple of cases where I do think it's absolutely necessary until we have more data, and that's through pregnancy and breastfeeding, and possibly young childhood actually as well.
Okay.
Just to be safe, because we don't have enough data on people in those phases of their life who are eating lots of these omega-3s from plant sources. Right. So we only typically have data on people eating poor diets and not getting their omega-3s, and then when you supplement them, they have better status and might have better outcomes. So until we have more data, definitely through pregnancy, breastfeeding, through young childhood as well. And other than that, in people with cardiovascular disease or in people with cognitive impairment, that seems to be where it's best. But for most other outcomes, people eating plant-based diets are already doing amazing. And there's not any clear data suggesting that we should be worried about the omega-3 status.
Right. Okay. That's super interesting. Now, what about because of course, like flax seeds, for example, or flax oil is a common thing that people often, I guess, take for these omega-3s.
Yep.
But what about, do you know anything about like algae oil? Because I know that's something that I've come across in the past and something that seems to be a little bit more relevant now. Like I see it everywhere now, opposed to 6 years ago. What is algae oil compared to flaxseed?
Flax contains the ALA, that short chain omega-3 fat.
Okay.
That gets converted into EPA and DHA.
Right. Okay.
Algae-based omega-3s, or algae or algal oil, as it's called, contains EPA and DHA. It's essentially fish oil, but it's not from the fish.
Right.
And actually fish don't make these omega-3s either. They actually consume microalgae, or they consume smaller fish and sea creatures who consumed microalgae. So it just makes its way up the chain from the algae, but instead of going through a fish to get to it, we can get it straight from the source and get it from an algae-based supplement, which is actually what I recommend in those situations I just mentioned, like through pregnancy and whatnot.
Right. Okay. So similar to B12 then, we don't get it from the animals. The animals get it from supplementation and then we get it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Although with the animal situation, I just want to clarify that yes, they do get some, they do make some, just it's unclear if they always get enough. So they're often supplemented.
Right. Okay, cool. So that was awesome. Those are like two super main, I think, nutritional deficit kind of questions that people always ask. But another one that I think is still very prevalent that I really don't ever have a lot of information on, and it's soy. So soy is something that I think people still, especially people in my world and like the fitness community, are very hesitant of taking and try and stay away from. Do you mind kind of getting into the whole soy myth and soy being bad for you, soy being bad for, I guess, testosterone and being bad for your overall health? Because I think it is a misconception. And soy is something that I eat every single day, and I have not noticed any of the myths that supposedly I'm going to be getting. So, yeah, do you mind speaking to soy?
Oh yeah, no, I'll go all the way through the soy data. Before we get to soy though, one other nutrient I do want to mention is vitamin D. Given
Okay, yeah.
if you live in northern latitudes, if you live in like Vancouver like I do,
Yeah.
also take a vitamin D supplement regardless of your diet. It doesn't matter what
Right.
your diet is, take a vitamin D. So I just want to make sure I get that in there.
Yeah.
But going on to soy, yeah, there's so many claims about it.
Yeah.
And for starters, it's important to understand that soy, yes, it contains phytoestrogens, but these phytoestrogens are not estrogens. They mimic certain or they bind to similar receptors as our own estrogens do. They mimic the structure to a certain extent, but they are 1/1000th the strength. They are very weak compared to our own estrogens. And so that leads them to having much weaker effects in our body. But on top of that, they actually preferentially bind to certain receptors in our body known as beta receptors or estrogen receptor beta. And now these beta receptors, they're concentrated in different parts of the body, like they're concentrated in bone tissue, for example. And we want estrogenic activity in bone tissue. That actually helps preserve bone mineral density. That's one of the reasons that women after menopause, when their estrogen levels dip, they have higher rates of osteoporosis or their bone mineral density declines. So soy consumption actually helps prevent osteoporosis. Now, those beta receptors also, when they're in breast tissue, can lead to anti-estrogenic effects. So they actually combat the estrogenic effect there. And that's why soy consumption, regardless of which population you look at, reduces the risk of breast cancer. It consistently reduces the risk of breast cancer. You can also take people who are predisposed to breast cancer. So those who have BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene mutations, which puts them at a higher risk, if they consume more soy, they reduce the risk of breast cancer. Even women who have previously survived breast cancer or who are currently battling breast cancer also have better long-term health outcomes, better survival rates if they consume more soy. So with regard to breast cancer, it's just beneficial across the board. And when we look, we actually have clinical trials where you feed people soy products and you actually measure their hormone levels. And in all of them, we see that it doesn't affect testosterone or estrogen or other hormone levels in either men or women, and it doesn't lead to breast growth in men. So this whole fear or controversy actually comes from a few places. For one, there's a few rat studies. So they take, rodents, they'll feed them really high amounts of isolated phytoestrogens in very high concentrations, so not like what you would normally consume anyway, and they run into problems. And there's two issues there. For one, they're using very high concentrations, and second, they're rats, right? We aren't rats. And then with the human data, there are actually two case studies. So two men in all of the literature on like over 1 million people that we have at this point, there are two men who experienced breast growth when they were consuming 12 to 20 servings of soy every day. That is a lot of
That's a
soy.
lot.
Like that's a t like one of them was having four liters of soy milk, like a
Oh my,
gallon of soy milk,
wow.
and other soy products on top of that. Like it was just crazy how much they were consuming. Even then, if you read those case studies, it's not clear that it was even the soy that led to the gynecomastia. There may have been other things
Yeah,
going
was
on.
it fat? Was it? Yeah,
I
okay.
mean, yeah, exactly. There are a variety of explanations, but even if we grant that, even if we're very generous to these, anti-soy people, and we say, okay, in those cases, soy caused breast growth, we're talking 12 to 20 servings a day over the long term, right? Nobody's recommending that. I mean, if we look at data on like 3 servings a day, 5 servings a day, it's fine. We don't see any, we don't see any real concern there. Maybe for children, you want to keep it even a little lower, around like 1 serving, 2 servings, 3 servings. Again, in these normal amounts that people typically eat, there's no real concern there. And there's all these other benefits to soy consumption. It's not just breast cancer. Soy reduces risk of, and there was actually umbrella review, they call it, where they take all of the research on the topic and mm-hmm. they combine them together. So it was an umbrella review of 114 meta-analyses. So right. to really boil that down, that's like a compilation yeah. of all of the compilations of all of the data on soy to date,
right.
if that makes sense. Like it's yeah. just it's the most complete set of data you can have. And it just released this year.
Yeah.
And they found that higher soy consumption, and I can't remember them all, but right. I'll list a few here, reduce the risk of ovarian cancer, of breast okay. cancer, of endometrial cancer, of prostate cancer,
right.
Lung cancer even,
wow.
cardiovascular mortality, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, lowered cholesterol, improved artery function, lowered blood pressure, improved yeah. cognitive function, improved weight loss, and also those soy phytoestrogens in particular, decreased hot flash severity and frequency and reduced vaginal dryness and menopause. And right. Those are just the ones I can remember.
Yeah.
There was so many benefits. And now there was one risk that they found, mm-hmm. and that was miso soup consumption increased the risk of stomach cancer by 17%. Now, total soy consumption actually reduced stomach cancer risk, mm-hmm. but miso soup in particular increased risk, and that's because of the high sodium content.
Yeah, I was just gonna say. Yeah.
Yeah. So the high sodium diet can actually increase the risk of stomach cancer. So that's what did it. It wasn't the fact that it was soy; mm-hmm. it was the fact that it was salty.
Right.
And we also have data on children. The American Academy of Pediatrics has published some good data on that, seeing that soy consumption is safe in children as well, and actually the only plant milk that is recommended to kids because it's really nutritious is actually soy milk. Mm. It is the one that's recommended, and in women who can't breastfeed and maybe avoid dairy products for, you know, whatever reason, say cow's milk allergy or other reasons, they actually recommend soy formula as well
right.
in infancy. So again, there's so much fear around soy and no reason to have that fear when literally all of the data points towards benefit.
Right. Okay. Is there any research around soy? Because I know like you were mentioning throughout all of that, there's no fear to have soy and whatnot. And again, like I've had soy and it's been totally fine, but mm-hmm. I know there are still people out there, even plant-based people that try to stay away from a lot of soy because they've kind of attached it to having bad skin or having kind of all of these other health kind of, I guess, negative effects. And they've kind of attached it to soy. Is there any research around like soy having negative effects with digestion or skin or things like that?
Outside of like actually having, say, an allergy or a sensitivity to that food, mm-hmm. not that I'm aware of, but that is totally possible. Some people are going to have some kind of like a sensitivity or allergy. Actually, interestingly, most children who have a soy allergy end up growing out of it by about age 7, or about, okay. I think 50% of them grow out of it by age 7.
Right.
But like it is still possible to have those sorts of issues with it. But yeah. on a population scale, it is absolutely something we should be recommending.
Mm-hmm.
And my other concern actually with what you just mentioned would be, you know, how are they consuming the soy? Are we talking like soy-based mock meats that are full of all this other
right.
stuff? Or are we talking about tofu, tempeh, soy milk, and those sorts of foods too? So
right.
there are a few things to think about there. But yeah, for the vast majority of people, soy is very healthy and a very a beneficial food to consume.
Right. Yeah. And I really like that point because I know I've mentioned it a few times and it's been something that a few of the other guests have brought up, you know, now it being 2020, mm-hmm. there being like this abundance of vegan friendly products on the shelves. I think that's something that everybody needs to be aware of, that the quality isn't necessarily going to be the greatest like it once was, you having, yeah. you know, Beyond Meat and all of these kind of things that, yes, they're good and they're doing some good things, but, you know, for the long term, they're probably not the greatest things to be consuming all the time.
Yeah, no, they're indulgences. And
yeah.
actually, we have research from this year comparing Beyond Meat products to conventional meat, actually, and they're still healthier. So
right.
that.
Yeah. yeah. but like, on soy, is there a limit though? Is there any research that states that there's a limit of the number of servings per se that you should be having per day? Or is it something that, because I mean, okay, 11 to 12 per servings, that's a lot. And if there were, I guess, negative effects, that's a lot, but that's not something that anybody is going to be eating. I know I have quite a bit of soy every day, but not 11 to 12 servings. Is there a number that people need to be staying around, or should they just not worry?
Well, all of the data we have, usually it goes up to like a few servings per day if we're looking at Asian populations, for example.
Yeah.
There's no negative outcome.
Right.
We simply don't have data on people consuming 10 servings a day.
Right.
You know, we don't have enough people doing that to really study it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're, my issue would be is if you're somehow consuming, say, 10 servings of soy a day, that's a lot of other stuff that you're not eating.
Yeah.
Like that, like, you know, you're missing out on so much. We want diversity in your diet. So, is there a certain number or a bar where we're kind of tapping out and maybe running into issues? Not that I'm aware of,
right.
But, you just want diversity. So why would you eat just one food, you know, to that extent?
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. That's a super, super cool point there. The diversity, but I guess speaking a little bit to diversity and speaking to like a point that I just brought up earlier about all of these new products, kind of hitting shelves and kind of being out there. Now, yep. There are so many products, you know, there's Beyond Meat, there's Impossible. Me living in Australia, there's things that I've never heard of that I'm seeing on shelves all the time now. But these products, because I think there's still this misconception that, you know, somebody's walking down the aisle and say they're a meat eater and they're walking down the aisle and they say a vegan label on a package. And I think there's this misconception that having the vegan label or the plant-based label equals health when really like not everything is probably that healthy just because it has the vegan and plant-based label on it. So what, when you, or if people are, let's say, wanting to go vegan, or wanting to become more plant-based, would you recommend these plant-based products that are on shelves, short-term, long-term, or kind of not at all?
No, I think short-term, it's a good transition food. Yeah. Or, you know, as the occasional indulgence, like, I mean, I don't eat those at home ever, but if I was to go traveling, for example, and maybe go out for a bite, I'd consider trying something, you know, like that. But yeah, like at home, I never do. If someone's looking to transition it, and let's say they just love their burgers and they can't really get behind bean burgers yet, maybe you try a Beyond Burger first and see how that goes. I don't think you'd really see a difference. So,
yeah.
So it'd probably be really good. But no, I don't think you have to go like 100% all in whole foods, plant-based right off the bat. I think you can absolutely transition over. You can experiment, maybe. You know, maybe there's one or two of these mock meat products that you just love and you want to include in your diet, but then you make the rest of it, you know, the beans, legumes, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay, cool. So how do people essentially, if they're wanting to transition, how do people, I guess, in 2020, how can people do it while staying healthy? Because, I mean, we've gone into all of these, I guess, nutritional myths and, you know, in the past, I think when I was first going vegan, I remember going to see my doctor and her being totally okay with it, but just saying that, okay, maybe watch for vitamin B12, for example, or omega-3. And I, at the beginning, I think got blood tests like every 6 months without taking any of the supplementations and was completely fine. But is there anything that people need to be careful with when first, I guess, making the transition, in your opinion?
There's one thing, and I see this pretty often, is under eating.
Right.
So when you make the change from a food that includes animal products to a food that's plant-based, especially if you're going like whole foods plant-based and really limiting any processed foods, you're probably going to be eating low calorie density foods.
Right.
That means you have to eat more overall food, more volume of food to get the same number of calories.
Mm.
So if you're usually eating a 4 ounce, you know, steak or something, or even bigger 6 ounce steak, well, you probably have to double that amount of volume in beans to get the same amount of calories.
Right.
If you're just eating the same size meals, you can end up running into like fatigue and maybe some unexpected weight loss and things that you might not necessarily want. And that's largely going to come down to just under eating.
Right. Okay. And I think that's an important point, because I think that's something that people maybe always fear, is kind of not wanting to eat more when they're going vegan, or just in general, not wanting to eat more, but like kind of remembering that, yeah, it's all about essentially the calories at the end of the day. And if you're eating less, for example, I mean, energy, for example, is something that is super big. I know when I first went plant-based, and even now, in the past when I was coaching, for example, I would always get athletes ask me, oh, how are your energy levels, blah, blah, blah. And I think one thing that I always mentioned was the calories. It, like, my energy was fine. I was just needing to eat a little bit more, which was totally okay with me.
No, I agree. I take like just massive, massive servings.
If you like food, it's good. But essentially, as a naturopathic doctor, and being vegan yourself and plant-based, how does that kind of fit into your approach with your work?
So, I mean, when it comes to, like, it's not just nutrition I do in my practice, but nutrition is the biggest aspect for sure. And when it comes to nutrition recommendations, I do my best to make just evidence-based recommendations. So, you know, I it's funny. I have a friend who's like an RMT, and she'll want to, you know, send me some patients. She's like, you got to veganize them. I'm like, that's not my goal here. That's not, you know, that's like, that's actually unethical. So, you know, I mean, in cases where I have a patient with, say, high cholesterol or a history of cardiovascular disease or diabetes or, you know, any of these conditions where we have just such robust evidence on, I share the information with them. And I'm like, look, this is what we can do. This is how we can help that, that issue. A lot of the times I've got a Google Drive with all my research on there, and sometimes I'll just pull it up with the patient and I'll actually go through some of these articles and show them what I'm talking about. But when it comes to just general health, I mean, there's a pretty good framework for what a general overall healthy diet looks like. And I would say the Canada Food Guide is an excellent example of that. It's you know, fill half your plates of fruits and veggies. You got a quarter of your plate whole grains and a quarter of your plate lean, like high protein foods, suggesting obviously legumes, you know, beans, chickpeas, lentils, and that sort of thing. But they also include some fish and I think a little bit of white meat and that as well in there. So that's kind of the overall framework, but I let them know, like, look, these are additional benefits you may get if you go further into the plant-based realm. And it's really up to them to make the decisions where they want to sit on all of that. But if it's a specific health concern they have, then yes, I can be like, look, this is the best data we have on, say, like a strictly plant-based diet. If someone's just looking at general health, well, then I'll just give them all of the information and let them ultimately make the decision, because it, they are in charge of their own healthcare, of course.
And I really like that points that you just made. And essentially, like, education is key, I think, in the long run. You know, you need to help educate others, and people need to be educated on what they're doing. And I think in the long term, it helps them sustain kind of this new way of life, whether it just be eating, simply eating more plants and continuing to eat meat, that's totally fine. But education is key. And I think now it's so hard to find reputable sources. It's so hard to find, I guess, education for people. So where are some places that people can look to, if they're wanting to know more about the benefits of eating plant-based diet, if they're wanting to know more about research, let's say, what are some resources that you recommend?
I mean, I already mentioned I volunteer for nutritionfacts.org. Dr. Gregor there has a lot of good videos on various topics. You can always search for different information. One that is really good is veganhealth.org. That's by a vegan dietitian, actually, and it's got to be probably the least biased, super well-researched resource out there, very comprehensive. So I do like that one. If people are on social media, I think Plant Proof is a good source, Plant underscore Proof. That's Simon Hill. He's actually writing a book right now, and I've helped him. I've helped him look at a couple parts of his book, help him edit a little bit. So I think it's going to be really good. And then, I mean, there's myself on Instagram. I try to put information out there pretty regularly as well. I think those are a few good sources to start off with anyway.
So thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was very informative and super awesome. I think people will definitely get a lot out of here. But where can people find you? Is there anything that you want to plug in? Social media, website, anything like that?
So I've got a website, drmatthewnagra.com. On there, I have some larger articles. I got a few recipes. I feel like I need to post on there a little bit more, but my contact info is on there. Booking info if you're in Vancouver by any chance. I've got all of that. My Instagram is where I do most of my probably content, and that okay. is at Dr. Matthew Nagra, dr.matthewnagra. And then I'm also on Facebook and Twitter at the same names, but I'm not quite as active on those platforms. So Instagram is probably the one to go to if you're looking to follow. And if you want just more information on me and what I do, that's on my website.
Awesome. Alrighty. Well, once again, thank you for being on the podcast. Yeah, this was very awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hopefully we busted a few myths.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. That is it for today's episode. I actually learned a lot, and I learned a lot of myth kind of busting tips. So now anytime anybody comes to me and asks me about, oh, you shouldn't eat soy, or I guess doesn't ask me, actually tells me, oh, you shouldn't eat soy, or you shouldn't do this or that, I can say, well, actually, maybe you should go listen to my podcast, because soy is actually not that bad, and I'm not going to be deficient in this and that. So yeah, this was a super exciting episode and a super informative one. I hope you all got something out of it as well. Sometimes it's super hard to find reputable sources out there, especially on Instagram. I know I always go to Instagram, but that's just because I spend a lot of my social media time on Instagram opposed to Facebook and Twitter or any other ones, really. So I know scrolling through Instagram, there's so much content out there and people just creating content just to create content. So it's super hard to find reputable sources and sources that actually know what they're talking about, sources that have the correct training. So be sure to check out all of the sources that Dr. Matthew mentioned during the episode. So of course, go and follow Dr. Matthew, Plant Proof, or Simon Hill from Plant Proof is another one whom I have followed for years now. I think he was actually one of the first accounts that I kind of followed when I first started my plant-based journey. So he is a very, very good one to go and follow. And yeah, I saw the other day that he is creating a book. I think he posted that on social media. So he is going to have a book coming out. Dr. Gregor is a different one. He is one, I can't remember what his Instagram was. Nutrition Facts, I believe it was. Matthew said it in the episode, but that's another one that is a very good source to go and follow. So just all of these people that have the relevant training and essentially have gone out and found the research and have found the data is just going to make things and the tips that they're saying a lot more beneficial to you. So hopefully you go and you follow all of them and you get a tip or trick. But before I end today's episode, I do want to ask for a favor from all of you. So if you are listening from Apple Podcast currently, please go and give this podcast a 5-star review. It really helps out the podcast. It helps put the podcast on kind of the I guess, pages that, you know, you could scroll through and you can find podcasts. And it just helps put the podcast in more visible areas. So it would help the podcast out a lot. And I know so many of you have already gone out and you have given me the 5-star review. So thank you so much for doing that. But for anybody else that has the time, has 5 seconds to go and just click the 5-star button, it would really help out the podcast. Again, just put it in more visible areas for other people to listen to. So yeah, thank you all so much for listening to today's episode, and I will talk to you all next week.